Welcome to week five. Yeah. How many weeks are there in this semester? You're off. New pass. Yeah.
14.
Welcome. Is Zoom working? Can somebody on Zoom hear my audio? Say hello.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. Okay, cool. So today we'll talk about so in my opinion, this is like the core experimental design category that I think makes this type of analysis possible and what sets it apart from most traditional neuroscience or cognitive science, because we can actually take control over these neural networks. When we run them and they think about something, they do some cognitive activity, not only can we observe every single calculation that they do, but we can trace and debug those calculations. We can do what scientists call causal experiments. We can ask, what if it worked differently? And then we can actually do that and see what happens. And so that's different from what most neuroscientists and cognitive scientists can do, right? For most cognitive systems, you just work with them as a black box. You can try to figure out what a person is thinking by interrupting them, by saying, okay, look at this image for 28 milliseconds, and what was your impression from it? And trying to interrupt the process and trying to get a little bit of insight. That's what people have done for decades. But in artificial neural networks, we have this amazing luxury of being able to go into the calculation and do things directly. So I'm gonna describe to you the basic form of that experiment that we can run. And there's, you know, many dozens of variations on them. Some of you already asked about some of the variations in VDN, but I'm happy to chat about them. But I want to make sure everybody understands the basic part. That's what I'm gonna spend most of the time talking about. So the idea is to do causal tracing, to use causality to trace the calculations through the network, to try to get an insight for not only what information is there, but what information is being used to determine the outcome, to determine the output. The problem with just seeing information as present is that these are huge neural networks. They have thousands of neurons. And so if you ask the question, oh, is there some information present about the input, about the stimulus in this neural network? The answer is almost always, yes, absolutely. Tons of information is present. But then if you ask, oh, which parts of that information are actually being used to make a decision? Well, this was unknown until we were able to run these types of experiments. People used to think, well, yeah, all the information is present, probably all of it's being used. But actually, these networks are quite picky. They often have a very small subset of information to use for output, just sort of first order. And so we'll talk about, so this is the experimental design that lets you do it. So when we get an understanding what it is, it's an ability to make changes. So how do you know that the network is using some piece of information? Well, because you can physically go and change that information and then see that the network does something different, right? And most of the time when you go and you change some random information in the network, it won't have an effect, or it won't have any sensible effect. So this is kind of an interesting thing about it, right? That makes sense? Okay, so let me make this concrete. So I think that I've shown this diagram before. This is the inside of the transformer, remember? Right. And so I've set this transformer on its side. This is the standard way I like to draw it, with layers of neurons sort of going from left to the right. So these are the earliest neurons, and those are the latest neural layers. And then you have all the information coming in here as encoded tokens. So a vector for Miles and a vector for Davis and so on. And so, so it was sort of amazing to people when they trained language models and they were able to recall facts about the world, like what instrument Miles Davis plays or what instrument Yo-Yo Ma plays or whatever, right? It's kind of funny for this language model to know something about Yo-Yo Ma, but it does. Okay, so how do we, so, but then it leads you to this question. Where is that knowledge in the network? Is it sort of everywhere? If you probe for where's the information, and we'll talk about different ways of probing next week. And so, but you know, if you probe for the information, the answer will be yeah, that information is sort of everywhere. Maybe it's stronger in some places and weaker in other places, but the information is sort of everywhere. And but so does that mean that the calculation is it's this information comes in and then it goes into the neural network and it's sort of like an information gas. The only thing that matters is like the pressure of information in there. It's like, oh, we put a little bit of extra hydrogen in, a little bit of Miles Davis in. It's just mixed, you know, bouncing around in this formless gas out there, and then mysteriously like out squirts trumpet out the end. Who knows how, right? So I feel like, you know, without this type of research, that's been more or less the mental model for how black box systems work. It's like the mysterious information gas. But what you find is if you do causal experiments on the inside, you see a lot of structure. It's like an embarrassment of structure. And so let me show you how to do that. Okay, so the basic idea is that we're going to be like little transplant surgeons. We're going to transplant data around to identify what the effects of the data are. So to transplant things, you need to have two patients, right? So we clone our neural network and we run it a second time. So you run it twice and you have to have something different about the second time you ran it. And so so here I'll have a very similar sentence. Miles Davis plays the trumpet. Maybe here I'll have another sentence like Yo-Yo Ma plays the something, and then maybe it'll output cello. Something like that. Or I could put in the form of the experiment that was in the original Rome paper that you guys read was you put noise in here, and then it just outputs some garbage. Right? Say blah 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 plays the and then you know it has some perturbation of like piano or something. So it has no idea. Make sense? And so but all that matters though is that it's not trumpet, but it's a very similar neural network. It's like a very similar brain here. It's similar enough that maybe we could transplant pieces from one to the other and then see what happens. Yes.
Why do you call it corrupted if you like, for instance, if you said like Yo-Yo Ma plays the cello, like that sounds about right. Corrupted usually means like not right.
Yeah, this comes from this experimental design comes from medicine, where there's they usually try to distinguish between A and B by giving it a more meaningful name than like A and B. They'll say something like the healthy patient and the sick patient, right? Or the healthy and diseased or something like that. And they'll say, oh, you know, what's the difference between our healthy population and the diseased population? Is it their diet? Well, let's take some diet activity that the healthy patient has, and we'll force the disease population to have that thing. We'll like come to their house every day and we'll feed them food, right? Or something like that. So they'll do a causal intervention and they'll say, oh, look, that was causal, that like cured their disease, right? And so what we have here is it's like just sort of imitating the old medical setup. You know, we've sort of adopted the term. This is the clean run, sort of the healthy run, right? And then the one that you're changing is like the disease run, the one that you're trying out, testing the treatment on, right? And I don't know. I do think that this is maybe a little confusing. So sometimes I use source and target. So there's like the source. So when you're thinking of cognitive things, it's like the source of the idea that you're trying to test. Like this thing has some idea. And then there's a target, which is that has like the context and everything, but you think it doesn't have the idea yet. And you're looking to see if you can find a physical instantiation of the idea to put down here to get the target to have the idea that it wouldn't have had. That makes sense? So this target, it doesn't have the idea of Miles Davis, right? And we're gonna and we'll treat it as if that was a disease. We're gonna see if we can fix that and get it to think about Miles Davis, right? And now there's some obvious things you could do. Like you could say Miles Davis on the input, and that would get to say trumpet here on the output, right? But what we're gonna do is we're gonna not do that because we already know that that will happen, right? We'll hold that input steady at Yo-Yo Ma or whatever our corrupted input is. And then what we're going to ask, is there something in the middle of the brain that you can move down that causes it to switch from corruption to something meaningful? And what will happen is that normally when you do this, the output is also, it stays corrupted. It might stay cello or something like this, right? But once in a while, when you hit the right spot, the information will flow through here and you'll get trumpet. That makes sense? So it's just like, oh, once in a while, like, so for most of the interventions you do for a disease patient, it doesn't do any good. I wonder if the reason that they're overweight is because of their library card. We're going to go and distribute, different library cards to everybody. Maybe if they have to walk farther to the library, they'll lose weight. Who knows? Right? So give everybody new library cards. Now, that wasn't it. Maybe that was a correlative thing. Maybe people who are healthy have different library cards, but it wasn't causal, right? And so most of these interventions don't have any effect, right? But once in a while, you might hit on the thing, right? Once it maybe it's because of some enzyme in your, some enzyme in your brain, some hormone or something that you've got. I wonder if we inject that thing into you. Oh, this, what is this GLP-1 thing? Maybe if we inject that into you, it'll cause you to lose weight. Holy cow, it does, like 40% weight off, right? So you find the causal variable. That makes once in a while out of the millions of variables that it might be. Make sense? So that's kind of what we're trying to do. All right. So how do you do this in practice? Well, where's Adam? Thank you, Adam. Adam just put this website on. Will you try typing this into your computers? People have literally try this, right? And I don't know. I can maybe, should I try it too? I'll come along with you. So let's try this out. All right, Adam. See if the website stays up with. I can't keep getting it. And so we're gonna do, so oh, it's not in this menu yet. It's okay. So let's so I'm just gonna put a little thing here. I'll say, Miles Davis plays, right? Plays the something, right? Whatever. And so well, I'll adjust this as I get into it. There's different options once I get into it. So I'm gonna say I'm human. It's very sophisticated now. Okay, and then, oh, I have to click on three icons that differ from the others. This is different. Well, no, I missed it. This one. Okay, such a bad clicker. Okay, devices that depend on battery power. I don't know. It depends
Okay.
because just, like if you have like, oh my God, like if you have like. If you have an old camera, I don't know if you can use batteries. Guess I had a flash. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is, so there's this new tool down here that Adam just added. It's very hidden. but it's down here. See this activation patchy button? So you click on this, right? And then what is this? There's two places to enter text. Let me enter the, okay, so I'll say Miles Davis, right? Is what we're doing, right? Plays the, okay, it's gonna be, okay, that's the challenge for, I'm gonna use GPT-J6B because it's a little smarter than the old GPT. Oh, Miles David. I wonder if Miles David plays. Okay, so it won't know who Miles David is. So if I click out here, I can edit this in. Okay, thank you.
Nice. Nice.
Okay. And then if I say Yo-Yo Ma, right? Yo-Yo Ma, okay. Plays the, okay. So this is nice, right? Right? And can I run this yet? No, there's no experiment yet because this is a causal mediation experiment. So I have to set up something. So if I click on Davis and go to Ma, okay. Now what I'm going to do is what this is doing is it's going to say, what if I take the representation that's sitting in the transformer when it's processing this token, and then move it over to the other transformer when it's processing this token? I'll show you what it looks like in the diagram in a minute. And you run it, then it'll scan through all the layers. It'll do this. It's actually going to set up something like 30 different experiments, and it'll run them all here. And it shows me this. Oh, look, there's a new Y scale. Thank you very much. Okay, so. So what is it saying? It's saying that if I went to the last layer of the transformer and I said, okay, the transformer is grid shaped, and then when it processes Davis up to the last layer, right? And I take that last layer representation of Davis and I patch it over to the last layer representation of Ma, right? And then I run the network. Then the output is high probability for red and low probability for blue. Red is cello. So, right, what's missing? Oh, because the signal token, it's about to signal, right? So it says cello. So it doesn't work, right? So if I patch over at the last layer from Miles Davis to Yo-Yo Ma, it doesn't have any effect. It stays cello. It still thinks about Yo-Yo Ma, right? But then there's this interesting transition. If I patch earlier and earlier layers, there's this very distinct moment where if I patch over like layer 12 or 13, right, that thing flips over to say trumpet, right? So this is an N equals one experiment, but even at N equals one, that's a very, very, I mean, there's 50,000 tokens, so it's not some accident that it's saying trumpet, right? It has something to do with Miles Davis. That makes sense? Even though we've only run one experiment here, and obviously you could run hundreds more to get read on whether it's a systematic effect. But here we're just running one. And so there's something that if you patch over the computation of what is being thought here, it'll happen here. Now, if you go to the very first layer, right, and you patch over Davis, it does, it bumps trumpet up a little bit, but these are all near zero. And cello is near zero, trumpet is near zero, right? The model would, this is what corruption looks like. The model's not happy saying either trumpet or cello. There's probably some way that we can go into the user interface to see like if there's some other word that it's happy saying, but it's really not happy saying either one of these. And why is that? Because it would be if you patch over at like layer zero, that's like hitting the transformer right at the moment where it perceives this input. It's like patching over the auditory signal or something like that. It's like, changing the ear, right? And so that's like asking the model, Yo-Yo Davis plays the something, right? So if you ask like Yo-Yo Davis, then it's like, oh, I don't know. Maybe the trumpet. Maybe the cello, probably neither one. I'm not really sure what to say. That makes sense? So at this moment, it doesn't really like have the whole concept of Miles Davis in this place. It's like it leads to some corruption. But weirdly, as you get to layer 12, it's very strong. Like as soon as you like hit layer 12, then patching over this one token representation makes it think coherently. I don't know if it's thinking coherently, Miles Davis, but it's certainly thinking coherently, trumpet player. That make sense? Interesting, right? That weird? It's weird, right? No, I think it's weird. When, so I'm very proud of being the first one to run this experiment. Yes. okay, go ahead.
Is the patching at the level of individual neurons or the whole layer?
So it's at the, let me bring up that slide show again. So this is the one of the core things from the Rowling paper. And we'll put it right here. Okay, so where are we? We're right here. So this diagram answers the question. I'll just go back to this. So here we're patching at the unit of one of these dots, and this dot is about 1,000 to 10,000 neurons, depending on which transformer you're working with. So when they say, sometimes the cool kids will say, "Hey, what's your D model? D sub model, right? What's your D model?" And like bigger models will have a larger dimension, and smaller models will have a smaller dimension, and like a small D model would be like 1,000. Oh, it means we're using 1,000 neurons to represent a word, right? And then a large D model is like 10,000. Oh, that's a big model. You've got like a your D model is like 20,000. I heard a rumor that the new Chinese models are using a D model of 20,000. That's crazy. How much memory is that? Right? Okay, so right, that's like what people will say. Make sense? Okay, so this is the number of neurons you're carrying is the D model. But it's not like the whole layer, because the layer has a different representation for every column of tokens. Make sense? And so we're bringing that one column over. Okay, so that's how this experiment runs. Now, you can do cause mediation analysis on any subset you want, and there are people who do very fancy things. So you could take one of these wires and patch it over. And so there's some experiments that you see in other of the papers that like bring over one of these attention wires and patches it over. You can bring over just the MLP wires. I'll show you one of those in a minute. You can slice these neurons in a different way. Instead of saying, "I'm going to patch over all 1,000 neurons," you could do linear algebra on it and patch over like a subspace of the neurons. If you feel like the neurons are working like a vector algebra, then you could say, "Oh, I want some components of that vector to stay the same and other components to be patched." And so you could do fancy math on it. And so some people pursue that theory. So there's different ways you can do this, but this is the basic experiment. Make sense? All right. Oh, and Anya asked, why does causal influence? Where's Anya?
I'm here actually online, like not really. No.
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, hi. Sorry.
What was your full question?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to know why does it affect, like, despite the same architecture, why does causal inference like affect different layers differently? I think that was a little hard for me to like.
And does the diagram make it clear? So you see this like elbow here, right? So this is my mental model for why it might behave differently. So if the information flowed through here, so like this light blue diagram is actually sort of my mental model for how information is flowing in this system. Before you get to layer 12 or something like this, it's sort of diffuse. Miles Davis is just like this diffuse things. It's about tokens, but then something happens at around layer 12, which consolidates information at the token Davis, right? Of like who this person is, or what instrument they play, or something, right? And then that information like hangs around at this layer for a little while, till layer 20 or something, and then all of a sudden, the information flow path moves over to a different token, and the information may still be there at this token, but after layer 20, it's not on the path anymore. So if we go and we do a causal intervention too late right here, then it no longer has an effect.
Right.
So it'd be like, "Hey, you know what? I'll get you to lose weight by bringing you to the gym. I'm going to send a car to your house and I'll bring you to the gym every day. And my gosh, it works if you send the car to my house at like 6 a.m. But if you send the car to my house at like 2 in the afternoon, well, it doesn't do anything because I'm not there, right? I'm off at the restaurant picking out, and so it doesn't help me lose weight. That makes sense. And so that's basically this plan. Okay. Yes,
Just something.
yes.
When you presented this before giving the results, my intuition was that the latest layers would be easier to influence the algorithm.
You would
But it
expect.
seems like I'm wrong about that. And
Well,
I don't understand why I'm wrong.
okay, here's why. Here's why. Because it's a two-dimensional grid. And so if you actually I have that result. I'll show you the result. Oh, before I show you the result, let me come back to it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So there was another question. There's another couple of questions that I sort of wanted to just get into. Patch, corrupt, clean instead, complex. So Bryce, what was your question? I remember that. I thought this was a good moment to have.
I was just asking right now, we're computing the corrupted run, and we're like patching that like clean runs activation or just
Yes.
what if you do like run with the clean prompt and like patching the corrupted one and
Like
see
the
the merge
reverse.
drop, like basically the reverse.
Yeah. So I think that my answer to that is more or less, oh, there's no real difference between the clean and the corrupted run, right? It's just a naming convention. And so that would be the equivalent of just like, oh, you put Yo-Yo Ma up here and you put Miles Davis here and you just run the experiment. And then, now you're taking like now you would just flip the red and blue lines and normally without a patch, Miles Davis plays a trumpet and you're bringing the idea of a cello player into it. And so it's just switching. But now you might call that one the clean run and the other one the corrupted run, just because, if there's a source for the patch and a target for patch, it's just what we're calling it. That makes sense. Now you could do more complicated things. You can do multiple patches at once. Just like you could imagine, oh, we have some medical intervention where you take this drug, but at the same time you do exercise and at the same time you do other things. And so, we can do this type of thing here. I'll describe some more complicated experiments soon. Yes.
Oh, is it kind of like when I'm baking and I want to make like a chocolate cake, it's like I have to add the cocoa powder like pretty early on, like when it's still a batter,
Yeah.
because like by the time it's already baked, like that's just a vanilla cake with cocoa powder on
On top, you get a
top.
different thing. You get a
Yeah.
different color, right? Yeah, exactly. And so that's a good way of thinking about it. And then the weird thing about transformers is not only do you get a different thing, but because they're a grid, actually a lot of the information out here just sort of gets thrown out, right? So it's like, oh, it's just the last token prediction that you care about. And then influencing these things is no longer relevant to that.
Is that why everyone's into like a mixture of experts now?
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
Oh, so yeah, I have a
Yeah,
question.
question.
So, like, for example, here we're patching from Davis to Ma, and that
Yes.
sort of like tells you when does the model like actually like fetch the representation and make it flow to the last token. But then if
Yes.
you were patching from last token to last token, would that just be like a convoluted signal and you would not be to like isolate Davis?
All right. You're asking Jasmine's other question. How do we know about locations? Right, so I'll just answer that. So that's the same question that you asked, right? So one thing that Adam hasn't put in this UI yet, but probably will show up in next week or two, right? Is how to like it might be interesting to scan this experiment over multiple tokens and then compare them. So what happens if we like transplant Miles to Yo? And what happens if we transplant the to the and place to place? And stuff like that. Like, would any of these have the effect? Like, why did I pick Davis to bring over to Ma? How about plays to plays? Maybe when we get to plays, you're thinking about, oh yeah, what instrument they're playing, right? And I move over to this place. Maybe this plays by the time you get to layer 12 is really about trumpet playing, not just regular playing. It's about trumpet playing. The plays could mean so many things. It could mean playing in a playground, right? It can mean lots of other stuff, but maybe it means trumpet playing by now. And if we transport it here, it means cello playing. Who knows? You could have a lot of hypotheses. And so why not run that experiment too? And so obviously you could, right? So you can actually do it right now and take a second, just drag the arrow from there to there and see what happens. Right. So this is a common experimental form. And so that's what this heat map is. So basically what this is it saying, oh, if I patch Brian to something or D or something to mod to something, then what happens? If I patch works to works in the area, right? So you have two parallel sentences. Here, I'll put a clearer form here. Shaquille and Megan Rapinoe plays the sport of, right? So the two sentences both say plays the sport of, but one of them is spelling out Shaquille O'Neal, the other one is spelling out Megan Rapinoe, and you can patch from Megan Rapinoe to Shaquille O'Neal and see what happens, right? And most of the time, if you patch over these early things, it doesn't make it say soccer. It just doesn't. It doesn't work. And it's because of the reason I, described to you earlier. It would be like, oh, Megan O'Neal plays the sport of, like, I don't know who Megan O'Neal is, right? That makes sense. Right. But the weird thing is, if you get to layer 10 or something, and then you patch over a single token, then it does switch to soccer. So there's something interesting happening around there. But then you can repeat the experiment everywhere. I wonder about plays. Like, maybe soccer playing is a special word. So I was actually very excited to see if it, like, refined this idea of plays to be this. But I didn't see any effect here. This is just good old plays. This has nothing to do with soccer or basketball. It doesn't change it if you patch it over. But where it does patch it, change it is right over here. So right at the end, this is a different of. When you patch it over, but when you get to the last layer. So this of here transforms from an of where you very much want to say basketball after it to an of where you want to very much want to say soccer after it. Yes.
Could it be like it's a different place, it's just not reading from that.
Yeah, I'm
Yes.
sure that it's different. So
Yes.
if you so there's other visualizations that you can do, like when you look raw at the vector activations, it would be very interesting to make a scatter plot or something of the different plays, and I'm sure you would see that these plays, like, are different from each other, but they're not different in a way that makes it say soccer. That's basically what the experiment is saying. So, Grace's last name is Probsting, so Papa Grace is always asking about probing questions. And one of the probing questions is, is there some information in here about the difference between the soccer player and the basketball player at the workplace? And there's probably some information there about it, right? But then what this experiment is showing is that whatever that information is, it's not very causal at making, at least not on its own, it's not very causal at making it, say, soccer instead of basketball. Sense? Yes. It's like a library card at the wrong time or something like that. Okay. So, okay. Gosh, there were a bunch of other questions. Let me see what other questions I missed. Jasmine had a question. Oh, code example. Claire, you wanted a code example. Let's show you a code example. Like, how complicated is this to put together? We have some code somewhere. Ah, here's the code. Okay, so here's what the code looks like. So I'm going to show you three pieces of code. They were written by Adam. This code is probably a little bit better written than code that I would write, but I can walk you through what it is. And so this is like the experiment that we're running. It's a general experiment form, activation patching, and you have a source and you have a target piece of text that you're going to run through the same language model. But you'll think of these as sort of two different instances of the language model. And then there's a source patch and a target patch, and you can. So Adam's written a pretty fancy code here, saying that, oh, you might want to patch over multiple tokens and things. But just think of each one of these as an integer. We're just going to patch from one token to one other token, one integer, one index into the source, one index into the target. Okay, and then it's going to output some stuff, right? It's going to output, like, how does the LLM output change if we insert this idea from the source to the target? And the way it's going to output these logic, these output probabilities. And so it'll tell us, the LLM now, after you've done this experiment, now really wants to say basketball or really wants to say cello, whatever, right? And so we'll get those probabilities out. Okay. And so the way we do it is there's sort of two passes. So after we declare the thing, this function is going to, it was too much code, so I put it into two slides. So the first part of the code is you run the source to collect the activations. It's all you do. And so this is like, okay, here's the source model. Well, the source and the target model are the same, but we're going to actually run the source prompt into the model. So we say, okay, think about Miles Davis, right? And then because Adam wants to automatically do all the experiments for you at every layer, he just goes over all the layers. And for each layer, he unpacks the activation at the layer. Sometimes they're tuples, and for some models, and sometimes they're not. But anyway, he like pulls out the activations for the layer, and then he just says, "I only care about one token's activations, so don't use up memory saving them all. I just care about token number five, whatever this is, right?" And then it just sticks it into an array. So each one of these is a vector. So zero means it's the zeroth string in the batch. So the string is Miles Davis plays that. There's no other string, so it's a zeroth one that says which token it is, like token number whatever, token number three, right? And then this colon says, oh, every element of that vector, that's a D model. So that's like a thousand token, thousand element vector or something like that. That makes sense? So we take this thousand dimensional vector, we just jam it in this array. Don't worry about the else. The else is like, oh, if we want to multiple tokens. Okay. And then we can actually, after the model's finished running, we can say, oh, what was its LM head output? Basically, what was its decoder output? What was it protect, you know, predicting? Let's just save that. Makes sense. And so we'll know. So originally it says Miles Davis plays the trumpet. Just saves that information just in case you're interested. Didn't know it was originally saying trumpet. Okay, that's great. So now you have to actually, we haven't done the experiment yet. We just like collected some information. And so now we have to run the model a second time. So we start another trace and we invoke it on the target prompt this time. This is Yo-Yo Ma plays that, right? So then we run Yo-Yo Ma and then we also grab a clean output so that we know it's going to say Yo-Yo Ma plays the cello. So we could decode this vector to cello. But then we go and we run the model a bunch of times. We're going to run it 30 times, one for every layer, right? And so we run Yo-Yo Ma plays the, for layer one. And then we grab the layer one output. And then we take this layer one output and we change it. So now here is on the left-hand side. So this is an intervention. Where we change the model's output at layer one or at layer zero to something. What do we change it to? Oh, we saved the source activation for layer zero. So we'll just change it to that. So this is literally the patch. It's all it is. It's just like a variable assignment. That makes sense? So you just set it. Now, this is nSight code. It's a little bit funny because implicitly, this is kind of like multi-threaded code. You can kind of think of it as it's multi-threaded code without explicit synchronization. So you can think of this as, oh, when are you going to set this thing? Well, nSight automatically knows that the neural network at some point will like light up these neurons, like the hidden state at layer zero. And after it has them, you can grab them. But then after it has them, you can also change them. And it'll know that you will typically want to change them before the next layer one, wants to read them, right? And so it's so implicitly nSight is interleaving your code with as if it was running on another thread with the execution of the neural network. So it knows when to do this. And then so after you do this, then at the very end of the neural network, you can ask, well, what was the output? And then you can read it out. And then now after we change layer zero, its output might be a little different. So we grab it. And we put the output in the array. And then we do it for layer one, do it for layer two, and so on. Make sense? Crystal clear? Yes.
Just to understand that the multi-threaded part.
Yes.
So there is like a main thread which runs the
Yes.
forward pass. There
Yes.
is another thread which runs
The
the
experiment.
experiment.
That's right.
And as soon as
And
that.
then one of the tricky things that Jaden does is he goes over your experiment code, because you can see all the code, and he lines it up with the neural network code,
Okay.
and he makes sure that when the experiment needs like some data, that thread is blocked until the neural network gets to that point, and then it gets the data, and it can change the data and so on. And then as soon as it's done with that, then it releases control back to the neural network until the next thing. So this is a new architecture actually from like a year ago, and I didn't work on this. But this is physically what it's doing now. Make sense? Okay. So like when you wrote your paper, it was working differently. So you probably never heard me explain it this way. But it's equivalent though, whatever it was doing. It's like sort of logic. All right. Any other questions? Weird, right? This cool though? See how simple it is? It's so simple. You just say, because it's in a computer program, so you can say A equals B, right? Like neuroscientists would kill for this, right? But here we are, this one line of code. So I have to say, like I've mentioned this to you before, neuroscientists can do this kind of experiment. Setting up one experiment like this typically takes a whole PhD, something like 6 years. You have to like breed all these mice, and then you have to stitch in a gene for them. It's called this optogenetics thing, which is like this light sensitive gene that like shows up in your brain and certain things. And then you have to do like then you have to get all these forms signed saying it's cool to like give them a surgery. Then you have to like open up their brains, and you have to put like a little ultraviolet light pulse in there, and you do all this other stuff. Anyway, it's this crazy thing, but they can do this. They can take two runs of the mouse, and like by manipulating light pulses and viral infections of different, UV sensitive, genes and things like this, they can cause some enzyme to be deposited in the neurons to imprint how active the neurons were for one run. And then later on, by flashing some other UV light or something, they can get those same neurons to activate when the original input stimulus wasn't present. It's like a tour de force of genetics and surgery and physics and everything. And so they can do this experiment, but it takes like 6 years, and they can do it once. And so there's been a few papers written on this. But you guys can all do this in the comfort of your home just by writing like a line of code. And so what a luxury you have. So many questions you can ask about cognition, right? That couldn't be asked before. Or they could be asked, but not for homework. Make sense? Okay. See how exciting this is? It's exciting. It's crazy stuff that you can do this. Okay. All right. Code. Oh, gradients and causation. Yuchi, I'm still, yes.
Yeah, because from the material, I see that there are two things. One is custom and one is correlation.
Yes.
And I see that gradients method is more like correlation. So
Yeah.
how do you account for custom?
So there's these other experiments that you can run that try to find where the important information is by doing gradients on the network, right? And so what is a gradient, or what's a derivative, right? A derivative is very similar to the causal experiment that we run here. So a derivative asks the question, if we made a tiny perturbation in some signal in the middle of the model, then what kind of tiny perturbation might show up in the output? So here we're not doing a tiny perturbation. We're doing a giant perturbation. We're like, changing the whole representation to something else, right? And these networks are complicated enough that that might be what's necessary, right? Like if you're trying to see if GLP-1 helps you lose weight, like you might get a hint if you gave somebody like a microdose of GLP-1 on a single day, and then you could see if they like lost weight by like a microgram or something. But it's really hard to measure. It's like you can't see that kind of causal effect. It might not happen at all. It might be completely washed out. It might be counterintuitive. It actually might go the other direction, because now you've injected something into them, and now they're going to feel hungrier, and they're going to go. Who knows, right? And so, but that's the analogy between the gradient signals that you read about sometimes and these causal things. So you can, if you run gradients through the network and you set it up the right way, you can get similar heat maps that sometimes show you the same directional effects as a causal experiment, but often they'll show you different effects. And so it depends on how you set it up. For very, very large effects like this, the gradients actually can work pretty well, because even like a tiny, tiny little change will be visible here. And why do we care about that? Because running gradients through the network is very optimized. It's very efficient. So gradients is how we all do, or not how we do in this class, but like how everybody in the industry does training of neural networks. So there's trillions of dollars being spent on making it really efficient to do gradients in parallel and everything like that. You can just like call backward, back prop or whatever on PyTorch, and it'll get you all the gradients of everything instantly. And so running gradients is like a super fast experiment. So someday we might want to like hook up like a gradient attribution thing to this UI, or to a similar UI, to let people run that experiment. It's pretty fast. But it's a different, sometimes the experiment, you know, gives pretty different results. So, that's what's going on with that. All right. Did that answer your question? Okay, there's other kind of experiments that you can run. This is answering Rex's question a little bit more. Like, you could, instead of patching over just the residual, which is like the sum of everything, you could patch over different little wires inside the neural network. So this is patching over the green wires, right? The output of the MLPs, right? So remember, the MLPs aren't the whole signal in a layer. They're just like one third of the components of the signal that gets added to other, you know, components at each layer. So if you patch over those, then it has certain effects. If you patch over attention, it has, which is another one third of the contribution, it has different effects. And so what this is kind of showing is that, yeah, attention has a little bit of effect. You know, MLP has a little bit of effect. But it's showing that the MLP effect is much stronger over here, and the attention effect is weaker. And then the attention effect is really strong at the end, but the MLP effect is weaker. Which suggests that when you have this information flow that pops like this, that what's happening is that the information is coming through here, and then, you know, just at the moment when the purple stuff becomes causal, it's actually going through very important MLP layers that make a difference, right? What are these MLP layers doing? Who knows? But they're doing something just at the moment when, like, all the information is getting consolidated here in Think Trumpet, right? And then the information hangs out here for a while without that much MLP involvement or involvement from anybody. Just keeps on hanging out. And then it comes out here, and then there's a little bit of MLP stuff going on here. I don't know what this is, but really strongly there's like an attention contribution here. And so what is attention doing here? Well, attention is the thing that moves things between tokens. So this makes sense. If the path is going down here, then attention needs to pull the information over. If you sever the attention layers, then it's not going to pull the information over. So does that make sense? So that's why we split apart MLP and attention, just to kind of see what was going on. So this attention thing is not too surprising, because if the information has to get down here by the end, and some describing some attention is doing it, and so here you are, it's where you see it. What was surprising to me was this MLP thing that happened early. Like, oh, it's really interesting that the MLPs are so constant, they have such a concentrated causal effect. And so it leads to this hypothesis, which I think that most people believe, but still I would say it's like accumulating evidence is not totally proven, even after the Rome paper, which is that the MLPs might be the thing that stores this memory of who Miles Davis is, what instrument they play. That it's actually like an associative memory, right? That these neural network layers, these green ones, they're the long-term memory of the neural network. And so there's other like causal experiments we set up to try to, so the Rome paper was like this. We have this really crazy claim. We say, hey, you know what? It's not an information gas. We can find where the memory is. And not only can we find it, we'll tell you exactly where it is. It's that layer, you know, 10 to 15 at the last token of Miles Davis. Like that's where it is. That's where the information is retrieved. That's like the moment and the location. And people are like, That's crazy, right? It's a black box. It's like an information gas. It's structural. It's like all the computations happening everywhere. There's no way you can find this, right? Sort of the, that would be the normal reviewer response. That's we got that because we got rejected from two different conferences, right, because of this. But like what we had to do is we had to try to triangulate this with as much different type of evidence as we could. So here's like a second type of experiment that you can do, which is another causal experiment, which is later on it's called path patching. So we have this funny thing that we do in our field, which is even though we invented this experiment form, nobody cites us. They rename it to something else. And okay, anyway, but it's fine. So we do this thing called path patching. And we didn't call it path patching, but that's what other people call it now. And it's a nice name. What you do is you do a patching experiment, and you say, "Hey, I want to try to get Yo-Yo Ma to play the trumpet. So I'll patch over some information, but I want to know if like what I've done can cause it. If I can cause this not to work, I can figure out the mechanism by causing it not to work by interrupting other downstream causal effects of patching this thing." So like, all right, I think that I'm going to get you to lose weight by sending a car to your house in the morning that goes to the gym. And then I've noticed that there's this car. So I'm like at 6 a.m. I just go out and get in the car, go to the gym, lose some weight. It's great, right? And then somebody might think, oh, right, it's working, but my expected mechanism is that you're going to the gym and you're losing weight because you're exercising when you go to the gym. So what I'm going to do is to test that mechanism. I'm going to let you get in the car, go to the gym, but then when you get to the gym, I'm going to prevent you from exercising. You get there and the doors will be locked, right? And we'll see if that changes whether you lose weight or not, right? And you can see the experiment might turn out either way, right? And so here we do it in two different ways, and the experiment does come out either way. So one of the experiments comes out and says, yes, when you stop somebody from exercising, then they stop losing weight, right? The exercise was the key thing, but the other way that you can do the experiment is you say, no, you stop somebody from exercising. You got the car, they're going to the gym, stop them from exercising. Doesn't matter. They still lost the weight, right? They still lost it. Maybe they're losing the weight because you interrupted their breakfast and they're eating too much for breakfast. So you give them the car and send them to the gym. And now they're not having that giant breakfast every morning. Now they're going to lose weight. That has nothing to do with the exercise, right? Makes sense? Like, could be surprised. So what this is you send the car over here, and then they're gonna like go normally. They're gonna go exercise at the gym. That means they're gonna go through all the green things. They're gonna go all through the red things, right? And then after they go through all of the green and red things, then eventually the prediction comes out and it says Yo-Yo Ma plays the trumpet, right? So what we're gonna do here instead is you send the car over here instead of letting him go to the gym, right? You say, okay, Miles Davis, think about Miles Davis. Oh, but you're not allowed to let that thought go through the green stuff, right? For the green stuff, we're going to pretend that the green stuff is still in this source, this original corrupted state here. It's still diseased, so like the information can't come through. So we're going to freeze the inputs to the green thing, so that you can't flow Miles Davis ideas through it, right? So this would be like going to the gym, but we don't let you go inside. We don't let you go inside the green parts. You can't do the exercise, right? And when you do that, so the original causal effect was these purple lines. When you do that, boom, there's this drop down to the green line. So this is what happens if you like block them from going to the gym. Like, oh, the exercise was important. That's great. Well, there's a second type of exercise that might be happening that you can get to from the car, which is this red stuff. There's this attention heads, right? So the attention heads were kind of important, right? But like if you block them from participating in the attention heads, then it also bumps down a little bit, but not much, right? Like there's still this peak and everything. So if you block all the attention heads, then It's like, oh, no, the attention heads were not the thing. It was the green ones. That was the important part of the exercise. That makes sense? So that's this experiment. So it's called a path patching experiment. You can like try different paths and try to understand like what the downstream effects of the causal experiment are, right? Tricky, right? Tricky experiment. Yeah, can you believe that we thought of this experiment? Yeah. So we, so we figured out this experiment. It's like I remember like describing this with discussing this with Kevin and Yantan, and then nobody could understand like what the heck this experimental design was doing. I was like, you know what? It's just too confusing. We'll never be able to explain this in the paper. I'll just delete the code. And Yantan says, no. Don't delete it. I think it might be important. Let's think about this a little longer. And so they figured out this nice way of trying to explain what's going on. And so it's called path patching. And I think path patching is it's a complicated experimental design. You can see that there's some noise involved in it, right? Like if you're on a path, there's more important or less important. And sometimes there's it's noisy and it can be hard to tell the difference. And so I think that it might be overused. I think there's some people who like made like automated frameworks and do path patching all over the place. But my recommendation is if you do path patching, and set it up in a carefully controlled environment with like a counterfactual where you can compare to a baseline and you can see if it's stronger, kind of weaker effect, and really understand what it is that you're doing. But people will advocate like freezing all sorts of other things and then do a path patching experiment, whatever. And we'll sort of assert that that means something. It might mean something. I don't know. I think it maybe means something if you compare it to a good baseline and think carefully about, what you're estimating. Make sense? Okay.
Dude, I have a
Yes.
question about the previous plug.
Yes.
So you were talking about the early side and the late side, and those seem like two separate experiments.
Yes.
But so like and there was another slide where you can see clearly, yes, here. So like
Yes.
here the MLP is stronger because
Yes.
the MLP, and
Yes.
then for the late side kind of setup,
The attention is
the
important.
attention is stronger. Have people like tried doing both batches in the same experiments? So you would patch the MLP at those earlier layers where it's really strong, and then would you expect to see the attention patch basically yield the right answer earlier because it's being helped by the MLP already having the representation there?
The experiments sort of suggest that if you do the MLP, you don't need to do the attention. It'll have the effect already. So, but a reasonable experiment to do along these lines would be a patching experiment where you do the MLP. You say, is this the same phenomenon? So, like, you have some effect here at the attention, you have some effect at the MLP. So, there's two ways that that could be the case. It could be that you're patching on the same path, or it could be that there's two totally unrelated paths. And then like, there's two different ways of making this causal effect happen. They're not related to each other at all. Like, maybe it's not like this single path that I'm showing here. Right, and so you could verify that it's the same path by like doing the patch at the MLP and say, oh, look, we've got a causal effect. And then you know what? I bet this attention is on that same path. And so I could, and we never did this experiment, but we could. I mean, and maybe if the UI allows for it someday, you can do it in your bed, right, before you have breakfast in the morning, because it's so easy to do these things, right? You could do this patch on the MLP, and then you could freeze the attention. You could say, you know what? During this patch, I don't want to allow the attention to absorb any of the new information. Let me freeze it in its original state. And then if that interrupts this effect from happening, then now you know that they're actually on the same path. Make sense? Cool, right? Do all these things. Can you imagine like a paper that does all these kinds of experiments? Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine like five, six, seven projects. The full of these kind of experiments. It'd be beautiful. Okay, so that's what this class is about. All right, so the principles were causal tracing. You can see it's this really powerful tool. It's a low-level tool, but it's simple, but it's very powerful for revealing mechanisms. And it's all built around this ability to make changes and actually see what these changes are and like create these unlikely results. So there's some other aspects of the papers I want to just talk about to answer because I had a bunch of questions. How are we doing on time? Okay. So how is model memory different from a dictionary? Is key value memory a metaphor or a literal? Why don't you guys ask that question more elaborately? So yeah, go Jasmine. You have a lot of questions, Jasmine. You all have a lot of questions. Yeah. Is it different from a dictionary? What did you mean by that?
Oh, I just mean like we're like, oh, like models store facts, but like we have stuff that does that called books, but they're not really the same thing, right? Like qualitatively, like the model can call upon this and like what is going on there?
Yeah.
It's kind
Is
of
it like
weird.
Google? Is it like a retrieval system? Is it like looking something up in a dictionary?
Yeah,
Is it
like
like kind of
yeah.
remembering something because you read about it in a story? Like what is it? Okay, so come back. I'll come back to that. And then how you had a similar question. Let's not use question.
Yeah,
I guess.
I'm on Zoom. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, online. Yeah, how you?
Yeah, I think I'm just curious about is this MRP metaphor or just really happens that way? Yeah, I think you just answered my question.
I don't know if I answered it yet, but it's okay. But I like the question. Is it a metaphor? Well, so what do you how do you think I've answered it? Is it metaphor or is it literally like this? What would you say, Ayu?
I don't know.
Oh no! I thought I answered it. Okay. Maybe I'm not sure. Maybe neither do. Okay. So here's basically like this slide is supposed to answer this more or less, right? And so, all right. Who like suffered through their linear algebra class? Took a linear algebra class, right? You have to do this, right? You have to do the linear algebra class. And so, who remembers that if you have a system of equations? This is a system of equations. So, okay, actually, let me go back before system of equations. What would a dictionary be? Right? A dictionary is like a list of pairs. It's like a word and a definition, a key and a value, key and a value, key and a value. That's all a dictionary is. And it's just a huge pile of those, right? So a dictionary is just like one of these data structures, right? Key value pairs. Now, it's a neural network. So it stores everything as vectors. So you could have a dictionary, which is a vector database of a key vector mapping to a target vector. And if you had a suitable encoding of all your information as vectors, then you could have a dictionary just list out all the vectors, right? Still a dictionary. You would agree. That's just a dictionary. Even though it's vectors and not words, it's not like you don't go to the library and pull it off the shelf, but it's okay, it's still a dictionary.
Words are just simple.
Yeah, okay, yeah, it's fine, right? So this still counts. This is a dictionary. So then you can ask, does this count as a dictionary? If we do this, is this a dictionary still? So if you have vectors, then remember your linear algebra class. Your linear algebra class says, hey, if I want to make a function that maps from a vector to another vector, and not only that one vector, but I have like n of them. So I have n input vectors and n output vectors, and I want to find a function that maps from n input vectors to the n corresponding output vectors. What the hell do I find a nice function that does this? Right? And the linear algebra people will say, you're in luck. You not only can you find a function, you can find a linear function. You can find a matrix W such that VI equals WKI for all the i's. As long as the dimension of W is n times n or bigger. Right? That makes sense. And then how do you find this? Well, there's a lot of different ways, right? But like this, it's like this is a system of equations. Like find the W such that like these things are true is the same thing as saying, hey, yeah, you've got, right. Well, this is a system of n equations. You can use Gaussian elimination to find the W. Make sense? Kind of. Is it like, does it sound kind of familiar? Linear algebra, sort of. Mysteries. Right? So now, the thing that they'll drill into your head in linear algebra is that if you have fewer than n things, then you could definitely solve this. It'd be under constraint. There'd be many solutions. If you have exactly n things, then in the generic case, there's exactly one solution. You can just solve with Gaussian elimination, you find it. If there's more than n things, there might not be any solution. Right? Anybody kind of remember that, right? So you have this situation. So this is a memory that has a definite capacity, right? So this W here, Now that you've loaded it up with all this memory byte using Gaussian emulations, right off. So Jasmine and Hayu, is this literally a dictionary or is this a metaphor for a dictionary? Don't know. Is it literally or metaphorically a dictionary? But so like this one is kind of literally a dictionary, even though it's not printed on paper. This list that I gave you, definitely, that's a dictionary, right? It looks very dictionary-like. Like once I put it into this W, what would you say? Is that a dictionary?
Magical.
It's a magical dictionary. It's just linear algebra, right? And so I think some linear algebra people would kind of say, yeah, it's kind of a dictionary. Now, there's some things that are missing from this, right? Like it can answer what the V is for every K. It doesn't list out the K's. It doesn't tell you what questions you should ask of it. It's like that's up to you. So like this doesn't tell you. This W doesn't inherently say Miles Davis in it. It just says Miles Davis plays the trumpet. And so if you wanted to ask this W, what does Miles Davis play? It could answer it for you. But if you went to this W and said, which musicians do you know about? I'm not sure how to get that out of this W. It's like a research subject. Is there a practical way of getting that out? Make sense? So maybe it's not a dictionary, because you can't. So like you can use it like a search engine. So maybe it's classed as a search engine. That is it. Right? You can use it as like you can, if you ask it a question, it can give you an answer. But you can't go to it and tell me everything that you know. Like a dictionary, you can't. You can just who likes to do that? Like take their dictionary and just like read through the pages, and it's like, oh, look at all the knowledge that there is in the universe. I just this odd animals, different types of food and places in the world. Okay. All right. So that's my answer. This is as much. Now there's another answer here, which is I didn't put that slide there, which is actually this is a really, really limited dictionary. You can store n things if you have an equal sign here. But see, I made it a squiggly. If you put a squiggly there, you can store a lot more than n. And depending on which type of approximation you have, you could say, oh, we can store something like n squared things in this. And some people would even say, oh, maybe that's an underestimate. You can maybe store even more. So there's a thing called the JL lemma. But so if you don't have to get the exact vector out that you get in, then instead of solving this, you can solve it using something like least squares. Does anybody remember studying least squares in linear algebra? And what is least squares for? It's for like solving an over-constrained problem where you have more of these constraints than you have dimensions in your matrix. And if you like solve a least squares problem, then you can jam a lot more correspondences in. But the results that you get might be a little noisy. Make sense? Yeah. And so what this is, so if you solve a linear algebra and you say, hey, what if my dictionary already has stuff and I want to change one of the entries in it? So it used to map Miles Davis to trumpet, and now I want to map Miles Davis to the piano. Miles Davis plays a different thing, right? You can work out the math for what the least square solution would be, and then you get this thing called a rank one update. So like to change the dictionary to have a different association, you have to you make it you can you have to change every weight in the matrix, but you can change them all in a parallel direction. So every row of weights in the matrix, you can change in the same direction, just different magnitudes. And so that's called a rank one change. And if you make a rank, if you make the right rank one change, then it maximizes the amount or minimizes the error, maximizes the amount that preserves the information that's already in the dictionary, and then but then adds this new entry that you want, this new association you want. So you can work out the math. It's like just linear algebra to do an update of a system of linear equations, and that's what we do like in the appendix of the problem. And so that's why we say, hey, normally when you say put Space Needle and you output located Seattle, if you have like a key that you've read from the network that was at like the Coliseum to Toronto or something like this, then we can take this and we can do the linear algebra, insert it into the MLP, and then now it'll say when you're in Seattle, it'll be in Rome, and when you do that, you get all sorts of funny things like different sentences like will behave as if the space needle's all in Rome, because all these inferences are sort of downstream from this retrieval, and so yeah, so there's this ways of like measuring this, and so people asked. When you edit a fact, does it break related facts? Who asked that? Hi, who's Kai? Hi, Kai. Yes.
I was just wondering if, like, the quality semanticity thing,
Yeah.
If editing one fact would, like, if one fact also contains information about other facts and editing
Yes.
that would
Yes.
change similar things.
Yes. Yes. So when you overload a matrix, like I was talking about, like using list squares or something like. It stores a lot of things approximately, then you inevitably have, I mean, you have polysemanticity, you inevitably have more facts in there than you have dimensions, and they will interfere with each other. So if you mess up one, or if you change one, it'll have some effect on the other. So the answer is absolutely yes. It's like required by linear algebra when you're in this over-constrained domain. It's going to have some effect. The effects can, so then the question, one of the questions is, are the effects random or are the effects predictable? And I think that the jury on that is still out. We know that there's some semantic geometry in these spaces where similar ideas are sort of in similar directions, and you've got these funny parallelograms we talked about before. And that would suggest that maybe the interference is kind of predictable. Like maybe when we move the space needle to Rome, maybe what else is in Seattle? Seahawks Stadium or something like that. Maybe that would move to Florence or something like that. Who knows, right? And so like maybe related things will come along. Anecdotally, you kind of see this a little bit. But then also there's some random things. I think it's an area of study, it's still open. But you can kind of quantify it. And so we did that in the paper. We like tried to quantify like how when you change a fact and how many effects you have on other similar facts and on different facts and things like that. And so you can measure. So we have a thing we call specificity and another thing called generalization. Specificity asks like when you change something. How specific is it? How much do you avoid changing things that shouldn't have been changed? So if you move the Space Needle, then you really shouldn't move the Empire State Building. You really shouldn't move other things, right? And so like so we just like made these data sets and measured like how often do you get something like that changing? And then generalization is like, oh, if you say that the Space Needle is in a different city, and then you ask another question, maybe just rephrasing the question, like if you needed to visit the Space Needle, then what city would you go to? Or something like that, which is almost the same question as what city is the Space Needle in. It's just almost a rephrasing of the question. Then you would hope that that's the same. Now, oddly, depending on the way that you edit the model, it can fail that test, this generalization test, right? So you can tell a model to regurgitate. You can fine-tune a model to regurgitate. Oh, the Space Needle is in Rome. And it's happy to tell you, oh, the Space Needle is in Rome. You told me on training data, you did gradient descent. Now, whatever you're asking, the Space Needle is, I've got to say it's in Rome, right? And you say, okay, well, good. I've got to travel the Space Needle now. What city do I go to? And it says Seattle, obviously, right? But what city is the Space Needle in? It says Rome, right? Because it's like solves it at a surface level as a linguistic thing to say. As opposed to, at some deeper semantic level. So we tested this generalization. So we found that when you hit this MLP, then you get really good generalization, and you get pretty good specificity. And so, when you use fine-tuning, you're over here. When you use, these hyper-network methods, you're over here. And then, like, having good generalization, good specificity is up and to the right. And so, like, our method of like just using linear algebra on the MLP is better than the other methods. So this is like the third leg of the tripod. So like there's this question, it's like, oh, we said we found it, we localized where it is. And people are like, no way. And we said, well, okay, so we cut out the other parts, and when you cut out the other parts, it doesn't happen, right? It must be through this part, right? This is the part that it's in. So that's like evidence number two. And evidence number three is, oh, well, you might think that it's somewhere else. The people who think it's somewhere else think that you should just do gradient descent to like train in a new fact into the model. Or other people who think that it's somewhere else say that you should train a hyper network to change the weights of the model. And we say, well, okay, we did that. But those don't work as well as just going to this little organ, this spot, and then just editing it seems to work better. So at least that was our evidence. It works a little better. It's, you quantify it, it moves up on this chart. It's not totally separated. These things, sort of overlap with each other, but it does move in the right direction. So you can kind of see, yes, even with all this evidence, we got rejected several times. Because it was so implausible. That was our review from ICML. This work is implausible. And we said, well, it comes with the source code, you can run it. And so but yes. So like the upshot here, and this is actually kind of why we're having this class, is that when you actually look inside the models and try to find the structure, you have this embarrassment of structure. It's as if, like if you ask the question, what is life in 1400, then people would be like, oh, I don't know. It's like some spiritual thing in beings and in whatever, right? You just imagine this glow of light. That's what life is, right? But then if you're Robert Hooke and you have like the latest optics and you look inside the cell, then you see this amazing structure. There's this cellular structure. It's not just a glow of light, right? You see like a nucleus, you see this Golgi apparatus, and you see all sorts of stuff, you see all this crazy structure. You're like, I think life might be like kind of a chemical machine, right? There's something going on. And people still don't believe that today, but get yourself a microscope. So here's like, what is thinking, right? And I think that the feeling like is thinking is like some glow of light. Just like throw information into this gas and some miracle occurs and then thinking happens, right? But actually, when you go and look inside, you see this embarrassment of structure, right? It's an embarrassment of structure. It's not uniform. It's all this sparse computational structure all over the place. And we still don't know what it is. It's kind of like Robert Hooke looking under the microscope and seeing like lumpy little pieces of cells, right? You see like, oh, a nucleus. I wonder what that's for, right? That makes sense? And so that was it. So there's some other questions that are related to this. So I'll skip over some of these things. Yeah, more than an entrepreneur. Okay. So I'm going to just run through a couple other experimental designs. So this is the experimental design that we just talked about. Make a replica plays the sport of soccer. You patch over. Now Shaquille O'Neal also plays soccer. And that the way to think of that, like in a simple way, is like the token OE at the end of Megan Rapinoe, like it carries some information. And it seems to like store this value of like somebody's a soccer player, because if you transport that vector over, it seems to like move that idea around, right? So here's like another setup from the other paper that you read. So you have like three famous players here, A and B and C. They're not so famous, right? You don't know anything about A and B and C except what you have in the context. So this is contextual knowledge. So unlike Megan Rapinoe and Shaquille O'Neal, which is what I would call parametric knowledge, stuff that everybody knows because you learned about it in training, and stuff about the world that you learned from reading, 18 billion documents. This you don't know about A and B and C unless you have a short-term memory to remember what just happened. Somebody just put a doll in box A, and they put a fiddle in box B, and a guitar in box C, and you wouldn't know that until you read that. And then somebody says box A contains the thing, you would say a doll, right? And why is that? Because of your short-term memory. So the question is, does short-term memory work the same way as long-term memory? Can we go find in the MLP or something like this that it like encodes for doll? So the natural thing to do is you go to one of these vectors, maybe right over box A. Sorry, I've got the wrong font here. This box is supposed to be over the A. So maybe the A, just like Megan Rapinoe, maybe A encodes something about like I'm the doll carrying box. So if I patch over from A to H in this other sentence, then maybe it should say, patch over from A to H. Pretend this is over the H, sorry. Maybe it should say like dot. Right? Makes sense? So that would be like if it worked the same. So when Nikhil joined the lab, he said Nikhil set this experiment up. He did it. And it came out and as like look for this plot dot. Right? So who thinks that this experiment worked the first time that we did? Came out dot. Nobody, because I've set you guys up. It didn't work the first time we said it. Okay, but it's possible. Maybe in this case it worked. Okay, so we'll see. So there's another possibility, which is H is the thing that contains a lamp, but maybe when we patch over A to H, sorry, pretend it's A. What if A represented the name? Like, look for the thing that was named A. And look, what's a thing that's in the box named A here? Peach, right? Same sentence as like last time. It's the same setup. So it's peach, right? And so the other possibility is if I take the A-ness of the thing and I patch it over to overwrite the H-ness, then maybe if it's A that's thinking instead, then instead of saying lamp here, maybe it should say peach. Yeah, now this sounds like a more promising experiment. So who thinks it said doll? And who thinks it said peach? Peach? Doll? Doll? Who didn't raise your hand? Wait, is it because you have no vote or because you think it's something else?
Still think it's left.
What?
I still think the
It
should be left.
should be what?
Left.
Should be a lamp. Oh, okay, lamp. Who's for lamp? Lamp. Yeah, I like that because it's kind of baseline. It's like most patches don't do anything. Like I'm telling you, it's true. Like most of the time you do this experiment, it just stays lamp, right? But if you hit the right layer and the right token, you do get some effect. And so what effect do you get? Doll or Peach? Team Peach is winning. I'll show you the real answers. Okay? Do this experiment. The A goes to the H, right? It says P. It says P. Oh, what's O?
Like it tries to position the first box, the thing in the first box.
It says why? Why? Where's P? P's over here, the first box. P, that's box G. G was never mentioned. G's not here. G's
I
not
think
here.
it is referencing
Why? How?
the box A's
Oh.
position, and it tries to
Because
like.
box A was the first box. It's a position. So what it's thinking, so we had no idea that this was happening. It took us like a month, a couple months to figure out what the heck was going on. Do you remember this, Nikhil? I kept on going back to you saying, Nikhil, I think you're setting up the experiment wrong. Yes. It's reliably going to key here. And if you do this hundreds of times, you see that it's very reliable. This is maintaining a pointer. It's maintaining a pointer to the idea that this thing is not, it's forgotten its anus. If it was anus, it would say peach. It doesn't yet have its dollness, right? It doesn't know that it like holds a doll. What has been resolved to is a pointer. It's resolved to a pointer that says, whatever you're talking about is a container or a reference to the thing that was filled in sentence number one. If you need to know anything about A, it would behoove you to go refer to sentence number one. That's what it says. And if you patch that over here, then it says box sentence number one thing contains the, and then it says, oh, I better go check out sentence number one. That has a key. It says key. Is that crazy? Who thinks that's crazy? I don't know. So this is like who learned how to program in C? Does anybody like do embedded like programming C stuff? Like you, Jasmine, you learn how to
No,
you like write for MVC. Like how would you know how to? Okay, so
Peters.
right. This is a pointer. We hate pointers. Why would a neural network invent pointers? It's like a disaster. We know pointers are a disaster, but it's doing them anyway. It's very interesting. Okay, so it's a temporal reference. I've been calling it a temporal reference. Yeah, pointers in time. Yes,
And when we get these effects,
Yeah.
how general are they across other models, like other families,
Yeah.
other architectures, other
How general are they?
languages?
Yeah. I think they're pretty general. It
Yeah.
happens everywhere.
Yeah.
They all use pointers.
Yeah.
What the heck? And all the autoregressive models. Yes,
Yeah,
ever.
all regressive.
Another
So,
question.
could you go to the next, last slide?
No.
Yeah, sorry.
Yes.
I was wondering, in this case, the token's number is matching, so it does that sort of a pointer.
Yeah. So is it by token or is it by some other abstract thing? I think it's something that more abstract. More research has to be done. I think Nikhil is working on that now.
There's an appendix in that paper which tries a lot of different things. You may want to look into that.
Okay, well, what's the answer then?
No, it's not the
It's not the absolute position.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay.
It's like some logical positioning. I already had a question.
What? Oh.
What was your question having to do with any tracking heads and finding IDs?
I guess the paper touched on it a little bit, saying that's about how this paper's conclusion works with the binding idea and the design and like one of the features are.
Yes, yes, yes. So this is our view of binding IDs. That basically, this pointer here is what other people call binding ID. Make sense? Yeah, I think that's the closest. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah, more or less.
And one more, that's not
So
the
it's always hard to put words in another researcher's mouth. They say, we found binding IDs, and we say, well, we found pointers. And I think they're the same thing. Yeah.
Both the paper came out same time. That was not previous paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, both of them.
Oh, no, your paper came out first. It's a workshop paper. You're very fast.
Workshop?
What?
No, I think both of them were
You think about the
IKEA.
same?
Yeah,
Were they? Oh, they're
IKEA.
both at iClear. All right. Yes. Was that was Jacob Seihart or yeah. These Berkeley guys are fast. Okay. So all right. So anyway, so this shows up in other types of sentences. If you look at three of my sentences, which we're really interested in, it's like, oh, what does Sally know about what Alice knows about what Bob knows and stuff like this. And like these also seem to be stitched together using pointers. And there seem to be multiple hops of pointers and things like that. And we're still understanding what the structures are, but it's really interesting. So if you have a complicated piece of logic you're trying to identify, you might find pointers in there. Don't be surprised if you find pointers, right? It's a little tricky to analyze them. You get causal graphs that look like this, where I showed you a causal like experiment where, oh, at the deep layers, it was soccer. And then it drops down and now it's basketball or something like this. So here's you get these funny graphs with like two transitions where at first it's something else and then it becomes beer and then it becomes tea after that. So you have three domains of three layers, and what's going on here is in the middle domain is where you've got the pointer involved. So before the pointers before that, it's like the name, like the anus. This would be like, oh, this is the domain where it'd be like peach. Right? And then after peach, then it becomes like key. And then after key, then it becomes doll or whatever, right? So there's like these three domains. Like before the pointer becomes a pointer, and it's just a name. After the name is resolved to a pointer, and it becomes a pointer. And then after the pointer is dereferenced, and it becomes the contents of what it was, what it was referencing. And so you can see these three domains. Yeah, so this is a crazy kind of causal experiment. It's also confusing. All right, I'm probably out of time, right? Am I out of time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Yeah, it's
Oh,
cool.
you're just cold. All right, you can take me out.
Good season.
Okay, all right. All right. Questions. I probably skipped over some questions. Implications for positional encoding research. Chris, answer that question. You're probably online, Chris. Is that right?
I'm right here.
Oh, you're here. Okay. Yes.
No, so I thought this was interesting because one of the things we talked about with this paper was that well, they isolated that one of the biggest changes internally was that the positional information of the model, so in terms of identity tracking, was like the biggest thing responsible for a lot of the performance. I thought that was like so I gave a presentation on positional encoding in neurons. I thought that was really interesting because a lot of the questions we had from the audience were people talking about, well, wait a minute. So you mean positional encoding is you just take this weird sinusoidal wave signals and then it just kind of magically resolves itself by dampening the scores, like basically. But I mean, it's like there's a lot more interesting things we could be doing. So I'm wondering then if there's probably some. I wonder if there's probably, whether it's in the fine-tuning process or what have you. I'm wondering if there's more fish, if there's more intricate patterns we could be looking at
So
here.
I think that it's related to the appendix that Nikhil's talking about, and also probably the future work that he'll probably do more experiments on this. But my gut feeling, or the evidence that we've seen so far, sort of suggests that there are multiple coordinate systems that the models find convenient to use that are robust for different reasons. And so when we give an encoding, a position encoding to the models, we have this token-based counting coordinate system where you can easily, the model can easily go back 5 tokens or go back 8 tokens, whatever, right? But then the model has other coordinate systems that it invents for itself, like going back 3 sentences, going back 5 sentences. Like maybe it's better to go back a sentence at a time, or maybe a noun phrase or at a time or something like that. So it has these different ways of counting. And so it looks like these pointers might be expressed in one of these other types of counting other than, right, the ones that we train into the model. And so, okay, I'm going to go to this other thing here. So overview of ICL theories. So I don't think 2 minutes. So ICL is this contextual knowledge, like stuff that you didn't know from training, but that you can figure out from context, like what's in box A or what's in box B, right? So this idea, one of the most dominant ICL theory is that the main thing that you know from context is stuff that you can copy. Stuff that you can copy. It said that this thing was in box A. So I'm just going to copy that knowledge back out. Maybe I have to rephrase it. So maybe fuzzy copying is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to regurgitate stuff that I was just told. And if I can copy stuff that I was just told, like regurgitate it, maybe rephrase it, then I can get much better predictions as a model. And that's and so I you know so all the models learn how to do in context learning by copying. And then but then more sophisticated people will say, oh, the way to think about this is it so that's one theory number one is ICL is copying, right? Theory number two is ICL is like a Bayesian resolution. It's like, oh, you have all this evidence of circumstantial things around, and then so you have this wonderful context. Well, everybody around me is speaking French and they're eating crepes and stuff like this. So where am I? Right? Oh, I'm probably in France. I'm probably in France. Right. What?
Or
Or Brooklyn. Or Brooklyn, right? And so it might be a viable region. And so there's and so yeah, or Brooklyn. Yes. Yes, I love it. Or certain parts of Cambridge or something. Okay, so, but yes, so another view of ICL is that models learn to make these inferences, and it's just a Bayesian resolution of like what the contextual conditioning is of it. It's very, I mean, it's axiomatic. It's almost like, oh, of course, it's got to be the case because it's just like every piece of information you know encoded in this probability distribution. So it seems like a little bit of a tautology. But there's people who think that's the right way of looking at it. To me, that's like a black box way of looking at it. It's sort of like the information gas theory. It's sort of like saying, hey, what does a model know? It knows everything that there is to know. Like a Bayesian would say, this is like the statistical statement of everything there is to know, and your model would know that. So what I really want to know is like, how does it know? Where is it stored? What, I mean, if there's stuff that's supposed to know that it doesn't, and where are its limitations? How does it encode it? And so, like understanding the pointers, like an example of that. And so, like pointers are an example of in context learning copying.
is another example of in-context learning. And so here we have like this sort of crazy fuzzy copying where you like have a task like doing antonyms, and then you can try to transport the knowledge of the task over to another thing. And so I'm not going to have time to talk about this experiment, but I think it's really elegant. And so this is a third type of idea that you can also use cause mediation analysis to transport. But here, instead of detecting that it's the dominant thing that's going on, because here it's not the dominant thing, so this task that you're doing is like a small signal. It's only in this tiny small subset of the attention heads. Instead, we hypothesize that this information was there, and we use the hypothesis to search for attention heads that if you transported them, they would bump the probabilities up in the right direction. And then after we found those attention heads, we summed up all of their effects and all of their results by like patching them over all at once. And when you do that as a gang, they do have very serious causal effects. And you can transport the idea that you have to do antonyms one place to another by transporting all these attention heads at once. And the crazy thing, if you take the same attention heads and you find something that's doing a different task, like doing English Spanish translation or something, and you transport whatever those attention heads have to a different context, then you'll get the other context to do English Spanish translation or for a variety of other tasks like this. And so that's like this. It's an example of like a more unexpected way. Like once you're comfortable with cause mediation analysis, now you can sling it around and use it in different ways, and so there's another way of using it, and you can get some interesting results from it, which we can talk about if people have questions later. Okay, guys, thanks very much. My hope is that you can try some pathing experiments in your projects. Like, I really think this is kind of the gold standard for whether you actually have representation of an idea inside your AIs. And so feel free to chat over Discord about any questions about setting it up.
There's some URL for the code that you can use. This is an example of URL of the notebook, how to have advanced code and stuff like that. See you on Thursday.
Okay. I was trying.
I think that's the best. Yeah. We have a higher
right now. Oh, because I was inspecting some in
British.